Chapter 2 Donkeys and Pharaohs. People forget that 200 years ago, Egypt was a remote land about which little was known. Today, the pharaohs and their tombs and pyramids are familiar to everyone. In 1798, when French General Napoleon Bonaparte arrived at the Nile, it was almost like visiting another planet. Egypt was far off the beaten track. It was a province of the Ottoman or Turkish Empire that was based in Constantinople, now Istanbul. It was an Islamic country and hard to reach. A few European visitors wandered through Cairo's bustling markets or visited the nearby pyramids of Giza. A handful of French travelers journeyed far up the Nile River. I actually own a remarkably accurate map of Egypt drawn by Robert de Vogandy, France's royal geographer, in 1753. Some visitors purchased powdered ancient Egyptian mummy, prized as a powerful medicine, even by the King of France. A few ancient Egyptian sculptures reached Europe, where they caused considerable excitement. No one knew anything about ancient Egypt and its spectacular monuments, although it had long been recognized as a center of early civilization. A few diplomats realized that there was money to be made from its exotic artworks, but the remoteness of the country was against them, until Egypt moved center stage in the 1790s. The Isthmus of Suez, the Suez Canal was not built until 1869, was a natural gateway for those with an eye on British possessions in India. In 1797, the 29-year-old Napoleon Bonaparte defeated Italy, whereupon he developed a taste for classical art. His restless mind was filled with visions of military conquest, and he had a deep curiosity about the land of the pharaohs. On 1 July 1798, his army of 38,000 men reached Egypt in 328 ships. Among them were 167 scientists charged with mapping and studying Egypt, both ancient and modern. Napoleon had a passion for science, and especially for archaeology. His scientists were talented young men, agricultural experts, artists, botanists or plant experts, and engineers. But none were archaeologists, for Egyptology, the study of ancient Egyptian civilization, did not exist. Napoleon's soldiers called the scientists donkeys, because, it is said, during a battle both donkeys and scientists would be placed in the middle of infantry groupings. Their leader was Baron Dominique Vivant d'Enon, a diplomat and gifted artist. He was the ideal leader, and his fine drawings, excellent writing, and infectious enthusiasm put ancient Egypt on the scientific map. Napoleon himself was preoccupied with reorganizing Egypt, but he took time to visit the pyramids and the Sphinx, the statue of a mythical creature with a head of a human and the body of a lion. His interest in science was genuine, marked by his founding of the Institut de l'Egypte in Cairo. Here, Napoleon attended lectures and seminars and kept track of his donkeys. He was fascinated when, in June 1799, French soldiers building defenses near Rosetta in Egypt's Nile Delta found a mysterious stone in a pile of boulders. It was covered in three different types of writing. One was formal ancient Egyptian script, the second a freehand version of the same writing, and the third was Greek. This stone would prove to be the key to unlocking the strange code that the French had seen covering the temples and tombs along the Nile. The soldiers sent what became known as the Rosetta Stone to scientists in Cairo, who soon translated the Greek text. The stone bore an order issued by Pharaoh Ptolemy V in 196 BC. The order was nothing exciting, but the experts realized at once that the Greek lines could potentially be the key to unlocking the unintelligible hieroglyphs, a word that comes from the Greek, meaning sacred symbol, that were used by the ancient Egyptians. It would be 23 years before the code was cracked. See Chapter 3. Meanwhile, The scientists traveled throughout the country in small groups. They accompanied the army, sometimes fighting alongside the infantry. Denon and his colleagues sketched under fire. At the Temple of the Cow Goddess, Hathor, at Dendera in Upper Egypt, Denon wandered among the columns, ignoring the sunset and darkness falling, until his commanding officer led him back to the army. Denon's enthusiasm was infectious. His engineer colleagues would abandon their work to sketch temples and tombs and loot small objects. When pencils ran short, they made more from melted-down lead bullets. The architecture was exotic and totally unlike Greek or Roman temples. Even the humblest private was overcome with wonder. And when the army sighted the temples of the sun god Amun at Karnak and Luxor in Upper Egypt, the soldiers formed ranks and saluted as their bands played in tribute to the ancient Egyptians. Napoleon may have been a military genius, but his Egyptian campaign ended in defeat when British naval commander Admiral Horatio Nelson destroyed the French fleet at Aboukir Bay near Alexandria on August 1, 1798. Napoleon fled to France. When the French army surrendered in 1801, the scientists were given safe passage back home. The British allowed them to keep most of their Egyptian finds, but ensured that the Rosetta Stone went to the British Museum. Though militarily a failure, the Egyptian expedition was a scientific triumph. The general's donkeys examined the passageways of the pyramids of Giza and measured the Sphinx. Aside from sketching the Nile, they also drew the interiors of the great Egyptian temples at Karnak, Luxor, and Philae far upstream. The drawings of the great columns, with their hieroglyphs, and of temple walls with gods and pharaohs, were remarkably accurate for the day. Their 20-part Description de l'Egypte depicted scarabs, a sacred beetle, and jewelry, statues, elegant jars, and gold ornaments. Delicate lines and skillfully used color brought exotic Egyptian art and architecture to life. The volumes caused a sensation. When people saw the riches of ancient Egypt, there for the taking, they went wild for them. The excitement unleashed a frenzied scramble for Egyptian antiquities in a Europe hungry for anything exotic. Inevitably, a steady stream of collectors, diplomats, and shady characters descended on the Nile in search of valuable discoveries. No one was seeking knowledge, just spectacular finds that could be sold at top price. Serious research, such as that undertaken by Napoleon's scientists, took a back seat to treasure hunting. Egypt remained part of the Ottoman Empire and was ruled by Muhammad Ali, an Albanian soldier in Turkish service. He did much to open his domains to merchants and diplomats, and also to tourists and dealers in antiquities. There was big money to be made from well-preserved mummies and fine art objects, so much so that governments got into the collecting business. Both Henry Salt and Bernardino Drovetti, the top British and French diplomats in Cairo, were urged to collect spectacular objects for museums at home. They did so, eagerly, which is how a circus strongman turned tomb robber came to be one of the founders of Egyptology. Giovanni Battista Belzoni, 1778-1823, was born in Padua, Italy, the son of a barber. He made a living as an acrobat, performing across Europe. In 1803, he arrived in England, where he acquired a contract as a strongman at Sadler's Wells Theatre, then a lowbrow music hall. Belzoni was a handsome, imposing figure, standing nearly 2 meters tall. He was a man of remarkable strength. He became the Patagonian Samson, a brightly dressed weightlifter who strode across the stage carrying 12 performers on a massive iron frame. During his years as a performer, Belzoni acquired practical experience of weightlifting, the use of levers and rollers, and hydraulics, stage acts involving water. All these were useful skills for a tomb robber. A restless traveler, Belzoni and his wife, Sarah, arrived in Egypt in 1815. British diplomat Henry Salt recruited him to recover a massive statue of Ramses II from the pharaoh's temple on the west bank of the Nile, opposite Luxor. This well-known figure had defied the best efforts of Napoleon's soldiers to move it to the river. Belzoni assembled 80 workers and built a crude wooden wagon, which moved on 4 wooden rollers. He used poles as levers and employed the weight of dozens of men to raise the heavy statue, then to move the wagon and rollers beneath it. 5 days later, the pharaoh was on the riverbank. He floated the statue downstream and returned to Luxor. Today, you can see the Ramses statue in the British Museum. Whenever local officials gave him trouble, Belzoni's height and strength proved to be powerful weapons. He was also prepared to use firearms if need be. His determination and ruthlessness, combined with his expertise at bargaining, served him well, and he acquired a dazzling haul of antiquities. Now, Belzoni targeted the cemeteries located on the west bank, where he befriended the tomb robbers of Kurna. They took him deep into the narrow passages in the cliffs where hundreds of bandaged mummies were to be found. Mummy dust, he noted, was rather unpleasant to swallow. The people lived in the tombs, ignoring piles of mummified hands, feet, and even skulls. They used mummy cases and the bone and rags of the bandaged dead as firewood on which to cook meals. Belzoni's French rival, Bernardino Drovetti, responded to his success by claiming digging rights everywhere near Luxor. He caused so much trouble that Belzoni preferred to sail away to tackle the Abu Simbel temple far upstream. Despite having to deal with rebellious workers and dodge sand cascading down the cliffs, with the help of 2 British naval officer travelers, Belzoni succeeded in opening the doorway. He found himself in a pillared hall with 8 figures of Ramses II, but few small artifacts to take away. Back at Luxor, he found Drovetti's men digging at Kurna. Their leader threatened to cut his throat, so Belzoni moved on to the Valley of the Kings, burial place of Egypt's greatest pharaohs. The valley had been explored since Roman times, but Belzoni had brilliant archaeological instincts. He located 3 tombs almost immediately. Shortly afterwards, he made his most astonishing discovery. The sepulcher, or tomb, of Pharaoh Seti I, father of Ramses II, and one of Egypt's most important rulers, who reigned from 1290 to 1279 BC. Magnificent paintings adorned the walls. In the burial chamber lay the king's translucent but empty alabaster or soft rock sarcophagus, in the shape of his body. Unfortunately, the tomb had been robbed soon after the pharaoh's death. Belzoni was on a roll. He had opened 4 royal tombs, and, ever restless, back in Cairo, he succeeded in penetrating the interior of the huge pyramid of Khafre at Giza, the first person to do so since medieval times. He painted his name in soot on the wall of the burial chamber, where it remains visible today. Ever the showman, he decided to make an exact copy of Seti's tomb to be exhibited in London. He and an artist lived in the tomb for a summer. They copied the paintings and numerous hieroglyphs and made hundreds of wax impressions of figures. By this time, Drovetti was so jealous that his men threatened Belzoni with firearms. Fearing for his life, the showman left Egypt forever. Back in London, he put on a wildly successful exhibition of the tomb and his finds in the aptly named Egyptian Hall, close to today's Piccadilly Circus, and wrote a best-selling book about his adventures. Inevitably, the number of visitors fell and the exhibition closed, but the former strongman still craved fame and fortune. In 1823, he went on an expedition to find the source of the Niger River in West Africa, only to die of fever in Benin. Giovanni Belzoni was a larger-than-life character who ultimately was a showman and tomb robber. One could describe him as a ruthless treasure hunter, but he was more than that. He certainly began as a booty seeker, out for fame and fortune. But was he an archaeologist? there is no question that he had superb instincts for discovery. Today, he might well have been a successful archaeologist. But in his day, no one could read hieroglyphs or had any clue how to excavate and record the past. Like others at the time, Belzoni measured success by the value of his finds. Nevertheless, the flamboyant Italian did lay some of the rough-and-ready foundations of Egyptology.